Welcome to the Quest. My name is Alan Mulhern. The climate catastrophe is evolving so fast that we have entered new territory, and this will be deeply shocking for many. I appreciate that the last episode in this mini-series has been long promised, but speaking frankly, a subject as contemporary, dramatic, important, and fast-moving as the climate crisis is full of surprises. We are faced not only with unknowns in the climate and ecological system, but also with inherent unpredictability in the human response. Recent developments in the unfolding climate drama have been very alarming, so this concluding episode will at first focus on this recent turn of events, which I suspect will be high in the list of climate response failures of the 21st century, and there have been a ton of those. The main points of this episode are as follows. First, the official predictions of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and other institutes have seriously underestimated the speed of change. The planet, I strongly suspect, has already passed the climate tipping point, and we are now into the unpredictable. One can think of the stages of this development as stage one, the unfolding knowledge of the climate catastrophe, which has been long in the preparation and its consequences forewarned decades ago. Stage two, the world gave its inadequate responses in a series of pledges, for example, Paris 2015, which resulted in mostly broken promises, leading to the cynical COP conference of late 2023. Stage three, the destructive fury of climate catastrophe is now unleashed. A tipping point has been reached, and there is no stopping it. Stage four, the fossil fuel industry has entered into climate defiance at the very time the catastrophe has entered this tipping point of stage three. The world is hopelessly divided, and there is no agreed climate policy. The green agenda is not only in retreat, it is in deep crisis within its own ranks. Before I give more detail to the above points, I have an announcement. The Quest lecture series is about to begin at the end of April 2024. This is distinct from these podcasts. This lecture series has been given every year by myself since 2015. That is, from roughly the time the answer to the question, what is the significance of the crises of the 21st century, became clear to me. The series this year covers the following topics. 1. The climate crisis has proceeded to red alert. What is the world doing about it? Is there a death wish in the human race? Why are we paralysed? 2. Is transhumanism the potential destiny of Homo sapiens? 3. Is the world fracturing along the lines of civilization? 4. Is there an archetypal foundation to the human psyche? And how can archetypes be a useful tool for growth and development of individuals and organisations? 5. Is there a spiritual answer to the crises of the 21st century? Can depth psychology be combined with the Oriental spiritual traditions? And 6. Is an apocalyptical lens a useful one to view the 21st century? The general aim of the Quest lectures is to examine the multiple crises of our time, using the tools not only of economics, politics, military studies, history, but also depth psychology, in particular Jungian, with its grasp of the mythological layers of the human psyche, the history of ideas, and the world's spiritual traditions. And, oh yes, not forgetting a little climatology. If you wish to register for this series of lectures, you may contact me at thepilgrimquest@gmail.com or get my contact details from the website www.alanmulhern.com. Okay, back to this episode. I now wish to explain the main points outlined above concerning the current state of the climate catastrophe. Stage 1. The climate and ecological crises have been outlined and explained for decades. For example, Rachel Carson in the 1960s on the impact of pollution, with an evocatively titled book, Silent Spring. Robert Heilbronner in the 1970s and 80s on the evolving ecological and nuclear dangers, in a series of publications entitled The Human Prospect. James Hansen, 1988, testimony to the US Congress alerting the world that global warming had begun. Al Gore, Vice President of the United States, who ensured that evidence in the 1990s on the accelerating rate of carbon dioxide emissions reached a global audience. James Lovelock, in the 1990s and 2000s, who gave clear warning of the coming catastrophe and gave us the theory of Gaia so as to understand it. David Attenborough, throughout this period, presenting extensive and compelling visual evidence to a world audience of the damage to nature from human activities. The Dasgupta Review in 2021 that confirmed and explained the onslaught on biodiversity. These and many more individual voices have grown into a crescendo in the 21st century, in which universities, institutes of all kinds, government organisations, NGOs, international institutes such as the IPCC, under the aegis of the United Nations, etc., have given a chorus of scientific argument and overwhelming evidence of the critical condition of the Earth. These have been accompanied by clear policy indications. It should be said that these come out of the West and therefore are looked upon with suspicion or hostility by China, Russia, Iran, India, Venezuela, and many other countries who don't align themselves with Western values. In episode 92 of this mini-series, I looked at the hypothesis that a warming Earth could be explained by other factors. None of them stood scrutiny. Frankly, the climate emergency could not be clearer, except for one more enigmatic variable that does need explaining: the human. Are we simply dominated by powerful economic interests, the fossil fuel industry? Are we so addicted we cannot kick the habit? Is it a death drive that is really in charge of the human race? Are we possessed by a demonic force that could lead us to such an impasse? Is it that we lack charismatic and visionary leadership, such as one seeks in wartime and national emergency? Is the world so divided and full of antagonism and hatred that agreement is impossible? Does the human race require world government with all its totalitarian dangers so as to save it from its own destructive compulsions? Stage 2. The inadequacy of response. The COP conference of Paris 2015 was celebrated as achieving international agreement for the reduction of emissions so as to hold the world to the 1.5 degree threshold, maximum 2 degree, you remember, above the pre-industrial period. This was a supposedly legally binding agreement to hold the rise in Earth's average yearly temperatures to this threshold, to be carried out by a series of carbon dioxide reductions which would peak by 2025 and then reduce by almost half by 2030. However, CO2 emissions are predicted by the IPCC and the IEA, the International Energy Agency, to actually increase by the end of the decade, rather than the almost halving that is required to keep within the 1.5 degree threshold. The pledges are simply not being met. The COP28 conference of late 2023 made commitments on meeting three big energy pledges on oil and gas emissions, renewables, and energy efficiency. Yet these will not be enough. Even if all three commitments are met, the IEA calculated that this would only amount to about 30% of the emission cuts needed to put the world on track for the Paris Agreement goal to limit warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade. Stage 3. The climate catastrophe has passed a tipping point and is accelerating into unknown territory. The head of the United Nations World Meteorological Organization, Celeste Saulo, reported in March 2024 that the year before that, 2023, was the hottest year on record. More than 90% of the world's oceans suffered heatwave conditions. Glaciers lost a record amount of ice, and the extent of Antarctic sea ice fell to by far the lowest levels ever measured. I quote from the Financial Times of March the 23rd, 2024. To an extent not widely appreciated, the world is now warming at a pace that scientists did not expect, and alarmingly, do not fully understand. At a Financial Times conference in March 2024, Jim Scare, the chair of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, said last year's spike in temperatures was, quote, quicker than we all anticipated. It was a surprise. Ocean temperatures were just off the scale in terms of historic records. It was completely unusual, and we still need to do more work to explain it, unquote. The FT continues, the unnerving implications of these findings were spelt out last week by Gavin Schmidt, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. Writing in the journal Nature, Schmidt warned that the data could imply that a warming planet was already, and I quote him, fundamentally altering how the climate system operates, unquote. The surprising heat in 2023 had come out of the blue, he said, and revealed that an unprecedented knowledge gap, his words, had opened up for the first time since satellite data began, to give scientists a real-time view of the climate system about 40 years ago. This gap may mean we have a shakier grasp of what lies ahead, unquote. Well, this sounds very like a tipping point to me. How come so many experts understated it so badly? I suspect they are locked into linear models which are not taking account of tipping points. Not that tipping points can be modelled, I should add. Also, they may well be afraid of being proved wrong if they overestimate. This is understandable. In addition, they may have guidelines, such as the 10-year rolling average to declare the temperature level of the Earth, which can be misleading at this point, sensible science though it is. However, the simplest but alarming explanation is that the tipping point has been reached and we are experiencing accelerating, more severe and unpredictable effects. For the first time on record, global warming has exceeded temperatures of 1.5 degrees centigrade over a 12-month period, which European scientists at Copernicus, the European Union's Earth Observation Programme, have said is a, quote, warning to humanity, unquote. The power of global warming is breaking all previous constraints. CO2 levels, perhaps methane also, are rocketing, for the simple reason that emissions are increasing and will continue to do so. Fossil fuels are set to continue their expansion, and the constraining factors on CO2 levels, forestry, vegetation and so on, are decreasing. From here on, we are in unknown territory. I see no reason why the Earth will not heat by much more than the 1.5 to 2 degree threshold. Linear models will not help at this point, since they are underestimating the impacts. Non-linear models will be attempted, but essentially, we are in unknown and very dangerous territory. James Lovelock died recently at the age of 103. Throughout his writings on the chemistry of Earth's climate, he explained simply that the Earth would be much nearer to the state of Venus if it were not for the Gaia equilibrium effects, by which life itself, not human life of course, but algae, vegetation, trees, microorganisms and so on, reduce or pump down the CO2 in the atmosphere. The sun is at least 48% hotter than it was when the Earth was formed. Our planet has already used up approximately 3/4 of the time we have available for habitability. Why have we not already been converted into desert? Our condition should be much more like Venus than Mars. Actually, they're both uninhabitable. Well, up to now, Lovelock explained, Gaia and her compensatory effects have rebalanced the Earth to make it habitable. Our Garden of Eden. Life can only survive on a cooler planet. Lovelock has explained that should the oceans heat to much more than 15 degrees centigrade, then life in them will begin to die off. Also, on Earth, the tropical landscape is not suitable for mass agricultural production as the Earth heats. Therefore, it is vital we maintain a cooler Earth. But we are doing the opposite. Let me add that the opposite also implies if the planet is too cold, that is more like Mars, then life also becomes impossible. Like Goldilocks, we require the porridge not too hot and not too cold. It's a delicate balance between the heat and the cold to get the temperature right for life to thrive. Carbon dioxide levels are 50% higher now than pre-industrial times. In fact, much higher than at any time in the history of Homo sapiens. They are rising rapidly, trapping heat and pushing up the Earth's temperatures. Examining the sequence of ice core samples, it is clear that it is far quicker for Earth's temperature to rise than to fall. Hot periods can arise quickly, and cooling periods, such as ice ages, take much longer. The reason is that CO2 levels can rise very rapidly, as a result of volcanoes, for example. But their being pumped down by Earth's vegetation and sea life takes much longer. It should be horribly sobering to think that the Earth could turn into a sterile planet, that there could be runaway heat effects. Life could not start again, because with the disappearance of trees, vegetation, microorganisms in the oceans, algae and so on, there is no means of pumping down CO2 emissions. We would have runaway effects and the planet would be baked into a desert. Lovelock has stated that the greatest threat to our planet is global warming, which is capable of wiping out life on the planet unless life itself, nature, Gaia, is allowed to pump it down and we stop the emissions increasing. I've heard it said that life could start again on Earth if humans were to disappear, or if life as we know it were to be wiped out. Asteroids, perhaps, or nuclear Armageddon by some psychotic humans. Well, not according to the above scenario. The extraordinarily favourable conditions for the emergence of life on Earth billions of years ago would no longer exist. In particular, the Earth would be much too hot for life to start again. This poses an extraordinary ethical dilemma for humanity. If we destroyed the basis of life on this planet, this is not just about us, or indeed about the other life we currently share the planet with. We will have squandered two other things. Firstly, the enormous amount of life experimentation over billions of years that have made us possible. Secondly, the incalculable life, our own and all other life forms, that is possible in the future on this so precious planet. We have an ethical responsibility to the whole of past and future life, as well as to the present. Currently, we can hardly look after even our own existence as we hurtle towards auto-destruction. Actually, we have little in the history of religion to give us a sense of this ethical responsibility on this scale. A spirituality of the 21st century must be greatly expanded from the limited advice of being kind to our fellow humans to include a vast ecological spirituality. Stage 4, defiance, division and retreat. I wish to cover a number of points. Firstly, the fossil fuel industry has entered into utter climate defiance, as mentioned, at the very time the catastrophe of the tipping point of stage 3 has emerged. In our last episode, number 94, published on March 1st, 2024, I gave 15 examples of backsliding on the green agenda. Since then, this backsliding trend has accelerated as the fossil fuel lobby realised that COP28 in the United Arab Emirates was a victory for them and a defeat for the green lobby. Here are just two recent examples to give you a sense of the turning tide. I quote from the Financial Times, the FT, 19th of March 2024, quote, more than 1,000 companies representing $23 trillion in market capitalization. That's a quarter of the world's GDP. These are the massive companies like Microsoft and Amazon and Nvidia and so on. More than 1,000 of them responded to a call before the United Nations COP26 climate summit in 2021 in Glasgow to commit to setting net zero emission goals in their companies. Since then, the Science-Based Targets Initiative, which is a standard-setting body backed by a coalition of non-profit organisations, has provided a check on those targets to determine whether they are in line with a global goal to ideally limit warming to the 1.5 degrees centigrade. Most of these companies failed the checks and evidently are not able or not willing to comply. Next example. At the end of March 2024, the head of the world's largest oil company, Saudi Aramco, was applauded when he told an energy conference in Houston it was time to, quote, abandon the fantasy of phasing out oil and gas, unquote. He said the world needed instead to invest in fossil fuels to meet demand at a time when the clean energy transition was, quote, visibly failing on most fronts, close quote. Thirdly, the world is hopelessly divided and there is no agreed climate policy. China, number one world CO2 polluter, has repeatedly said it will not follow the carbon net zero program for 2050 and has abandoned the Paris Agreement. Russia and India are of a similar mind. China and India flatly refuse to restrain their huge domestic coal consumption, the dirtiest of the carbon dioxide polluters. To add to the list of embarrassing difficulties, the United States, number two emitter of CO2 in the world, and at the moment plenty of fine words on the green agenda, happens to be at peak oil and gas production in 2023. Fourthly, retreat and crisis of the green agenda. As an example of this, I quote from a recent March 2024 article in the Heritage Foundation by Diana Furchgott-Roth, who is the director of Center for Energy, Climate and the Environment in the United States. The title of the article is China Abandons Paris Agreement, Making US Efforts Painful and Pointless. And it captures succinctly the above points, namely the retreat and crisis in the green ranks and the international lack of agreement undermining progress. In it, she points out, firstly, China's leader Xi Jinping has repeatedly said that China is not part of the 2050 carbon zero plan of the West. For example, in October 2022, he said that, quote, China would not abandon the coal-fired power plants before renewables could substitute for the lost fossil fuel. But Diana Roth, writing this article, says, but this substitution will not occur of renewables for fossil fuel. This will not occur because fossil fuels generate substantially more energy than renewables. unquote, which is true. Secondly, the United States, as part of the Carbon Zero Initiative, is implementing an electric vehicles strategy, EV strategy, at great cost to the country and the consumer. An EV costs $10,000 to $25,000 more than a petrol car. She says that this conversion to EVs will have negligible impact on world emissions, since the electricity for the vast EV fleet will be generated from fossil fuels. Added to this, that China, India and others are not part of the Carbon Zero Initiative and fully intend to continue with electricity generation as normal. What is the point, she asks, of one country or one bloc struggling to achieve net zero by 2050, when other countries, who are major emitters of greenhouse gases, have no intention of keeping to their pledges, if they had them in the first place? Demoralisation sets in and the green agenda is abandoned. Thus argues Diana Roth, for America to transition to electric vehicles is all pain and no gain. The next point I want to cover in this section on defiance, division and retreat is that the green agenda, of course, is not going to go away, no matter what temporary difficulties it passes through. And when China, India and America, major polluters, begin to actually suffer more acutely, then the message might get home. Pressure to transition to renewables can only increase as the climate crisis accelerates. The real total cost of maintaining fossil fuels as our chief energy source are increasing exponentially, since global warming is incredibly damaging and potentially lethal. These include costs in health, lost agriculture, damage from storm, flood and fire, devastation of biodiversity, and so on. But the cost of rising sea levels due to melting polar ice are incalculable and are a complete game changer. 10% of the world's population live in cities a few metres above sea level. A recent study, based on data from the National Centre for Environmental Information, demonstrates large-scale climate disasters in the United States have cost more than $2 trillion, $2,000 billion, in recovery costs, that is to recover from the damage, over the last 40 years, as climate damage increases dramatically. In the United States, as a result, operators, for example, of critical infrastructure, such as power utilities, railway operators, national defence and so on, are realising that the costs of inaction are beginning to outweigh the cost of action. For example, in an analysis of climate change and the power utility industry in the United States, the costs of modernising the grid for improved resilience to climate change were estimated at $700 million, up to $1 billion, per utility, far lower than the costs incurred from the estimated climate change fuel storms, put at $1.7 billion per utility over 20 years. And that is just the cost to a large utility at a single company, large electricity generating plant, for example. The benefits of modernisation offset the costs further with improved efficiency and productivity gains from enhanced automation and predictive maintenance capabilities and much more. It's going to be far, far cheaper to engage in the transition in the long run than to put up with the damage of fossil fuel climate-induced disaster. As the climate damage bites deeper into the world economy, more accurate pictures of the enormous costs of our negligence will become apparent, and the tide will swing back in favour of the green transition once more. However, we're almost out of time. We're already past a tipping point, in my opinion, and there'll be an acceleration of damage in the near future. I could go on with numerous examples of how the green revolution is costing much, much more than originally anticipated, and this has caused consternation and even despair in the green ranks. For without a cost advantage, companies, industries and even consumers in the West will not adopt the green agenda. But, to repeat, that is not taking into account the true costs of the damage increasingly caused by climate change. In conclusion, firstly, a tipping point has been reached. Secondly, climate defiance is in the ascendant at the moment, and there is crisis, confusion, and perhaps despair in the ranks of the Greens. However, although the costs of the green transition have, in fact, been underestimated, and its efficiency at this stage overrated, this is only one round in an epic battle. The green agenda will make a comeback as the true damaging costs of fossil dependency hammer home. Thirdly, it is my view that the climate crisis, as well as the others of the 21st century, have to be gone through. Quick fixes are not possible. It is useful to view this whole period as a rite of passage. This does not mean that humanity will necessarily get through it. We might fail, or we might not make it in one piece. But what is required is a total paradigm shift in human values and in political and economic organisation. More of which in later episodes as we explore the crises of the 21st century. This is the end of the mini-series on the ecological disaster of our times. Its main takeaway points are as follows. 1. The ecological catastrophe of our times is a large assembly of crises, within which the climate is the most urgent. 2. CO2 levels move inexorably upwards, and what we have done is too little and too late to prevent global warming surging through the 1.5 degrees centigrade threshold. And what is there to prevent it continuing? We have now passed a tipping point, and runaway effects are to be expected. 3. The consequences of global warming are devastating on every conceivable level. 4. The cause of this is anthropogenic, that is, caused by humans. 5. We have been unable to break this destructive momentum. There is precious little international agreement. Pledges have been broken. Costs of the renewable transition are much higher than expected. And any trust or belief that international agreement could find a solution is vanishing. 6. Most governments in the world, especially those with huge fossil fuel resources, most industries, firms, and even consumers and households are not prepared to really accept a transition and its consequences, at least at this conjuncture. Almost everyone requires the new energy source to be as cheap and reliable as oil, gas, and coal, and the cost of conversion to be minimal. Everybody wants the gain and no pain. 7. However, pain is coming, and plenty of it, as the costs of not transitioning away from fossil fuels increase exponentially. 8. We cannot give up on what is an existential policy necessity, the transitioning of the whole of humanity to clean and renewable energy sources. However, the additional policy recommendation is now to prepare for survival on a fast degrading planet. And this is something quite new. Our next episode will consider the metaphysical and psychoanalytic dimensions to human destructiveness. I hope you can join me.